I would say one thing that you've got to keep in mind, and I remind myself all the time about in climate, is reality is not rationality. As someone who started my career on the more product side things, it's easy to think that things are rational out in the world, and that's not really the case. An example in climate is take fusion. It's something that people look at. The joke is always that it's the power source of the next 40 years, but it's 40 years away. And there's a number of other pieces, but the key there is it takes a really long time. Yet venture is something that has a very defined time frame. And so I will readily admit I've got a number of questions about how people are coming up with creative self-justification math to make that work.
Welcome back to the Clean Techies podcast, where we interview the top climate founders and VCs to get their best advice for you. In this episode, I chat with Logan Grizzle, partner at Muse Climate Partners, the climate tech venture capital arm of Muse & Co., investing at the convergence of decarbonization and technological innovation. This episode probably broke the quotable clip record that we have because Logan was a great mix of knowing how to communicate his thoughts and genuinely having such unique insight, having worked at Alternative Fuels at Toyota, going into grid strategy on the management consultant side, and now spending time as a climate VC, previously at Blackhorn Ventures and now at Muse Climate Partners. In this episode, we talk about the challenge with timeframes of venture funds and climate, his perspective on nuclear fusion, alternative fuels at Toyota, centralized versus decentralized grids, the nuances of hardware, the climate tech scene in Denver, how they got such a diverse team, and more. I also want to quickly note that I frequently called Muse Climate Partners Muse Capital Partners. I don't know why that keeps getting me tongue-tied, but this is me letting you know that it should be Muse Climate Partners. Anyways, thanks so much for listening and enjoy the episode. A quick reminder that we have launched a Patreon. Please check it out in the description or our Substack. We're trying to do bigger and better things, and every bit of your support means the world to us. Now, back to it. All right, Logan, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing well. What about you, Samil?
I'm doing all right. We were just talking about this before the show started, but it was 60 here in New York for the first time in probably 5 months, and I felt happier, and I could tell what, you know, seasonal depression is and what it does to you. So it's been a really, really good, you know, past, I'd say, 24 to 48 hours. How about you?
Very much the same. I'm here in Denver. Of course, we always worry when it gets into the 60s this time of year, but it's happening more and more often. So that's why we're all involved in climate.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's, you gave me the perfect transition, involved in climate. You run a climate VC firm. I think our conversation today will be super fun. You have a lot of really cool experience going back to Toyota, Blackhorn Ventures, you know, and of course, now where you are. Teasing that a little bit with Muse Capital Partner or Climate Partners. But before we get into that, the thing I want to ask you is, you know, there's a lot of things that are top of mind in climate VC, and you as an investment professional get to see a lot of these things. One thing we talked about that I'd love to kick off with is herd mentality. People go in a very specific direction. Everyone looks at the same things, reads the same news articles, and that's great. But a big gesture, a big point about venture is that you can't always go where everyone's going. And that's really not how you generate returns. So my question to you is there anything that people are doing today in climate that you are not necessarily pursuing?
Absolutely. I would say one thing that you've got to keep in mind, and I remind myself all the time about in climate, is reality is not rationality. As someone who started my career on the more product side things, it's easy to think that things are rational out in the world. And that's not really the case. An example in climate is take fusion. It's something that people look at. The joke is always that it's the power source of the next 40 years, but it's 40 years away. And there's a number of other pieces, but the key there is it takes a really long time. Yet venture is something that has a very defined time frame. And so I will readily admit I've got a number of questions about how people are coming up with creative self-justification math to make that work. And there's also issues that you've just got to consider, like real go-to-market issues. Fusion generates over 10x the waste of fission, and we already have problems dealing with fission. So it's lower radioactivity waste, but you generate so much more of it. You've got to figure out how do you deal with that. It also generates a whole lot more neutrons, which means it's actually easier to make things like bomb-grade material. Right now, that's not a problem because we don't have a whole lot of plants out there. But in the future, that's something you'll have to consider. There's a number of other pieces, but all of these are small little go-to-market hurdles that people, you know, are suspending disbelief on, and there's probably an easier way.
Those points were very different, so I want to tap into the first. That really piqued my interest, which is, you know, the time scale that you're thinking about in terms of venture investing. So what do you mean by that?
So your average venture fund, as you may know, is a 10-year fund. You've got an investment period, which is typically 2 or 4 years, and then you've got time to mature. And at the end of that, you really want the fund to return. Yes, you can extend if your LPs let you type thing, but the problem is they want their money back. And if you want to raise a new fund, you need to give them their money back, because investors will give more money to people who return their money. And if you wait to return it till 20 years out, that there's a problem there. And so taking a step back, this is not unique to Fusion, but it's a problem and a challenge that all climate faces. If you want to deal with a real world problem that's a physical thing, you got to build something physical. If you're moving at breakneck speed, it takes you 5 years to build that, get it up, get it to a product that's really market ready. Then you've got a product, but nobody knows about you. So it's probably going to take you another 5 years to get people to figure out, okay, this group exists. And then you can go scale and move from your initial geographies to multiple geographies to really build that out. And that's just a bit of a hand-waving piece, but that's 15 years. The problem is we're on a 10-year fund cycle. So you've got to, as a venture person, you've got to catch stuff at the right cycle if you want to do that kind of hard work. That's why so much of venture is software. You can do a new software run about every week or two. So it's 26 or 52 builds a year. If you're doing hardware, you're lucky if it's a build a quarter. And so that's just, you got to deal with that.
Definitely. And that's why I think the climate capital stack came to be, right? Venture isn't the right style of investing, or always the right. Like you said, sometimes venture software in climate works, but it's not always the best fit. This is actually really, really, really topical, because Sam Altman was famously quoted recently when talking about compute power, the growth of what generative AI is doing and how the energy crisis, and he quoted Fusion as my answer, you know, as his answer of like, Fusion is what's going to get us there. So when you look at a grand energy need, an energy crisis, and someone proposes Fusion, what are the things that come to your head about what they're not considering?
You know, it's the old adage, if all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. When you look at the power grid, we built it a certain way. We built it with these big, large plants and then a whole bunch of connectivity. And then if you needed more power, you just threw more coal into the plant. It was throttleable like a gas pedal. And you don't have to do that now. We have more intelligent ways of controlling stuff. And we also can generate power at a more distributed nature with solar and wind. I actually think a lot of what people are saying when they do this, they're ignoring the fact that we have modern controls and that you actually don't need an old baseload style plant anymore. People say, anytime you hear someone say, we need all of the above, that's somebody who's an apologist for some industry, usually an old traditional industry. In reality, you don't. The new stuff enables you to use new stuff in a way that can accomplish a whole lot more. And, you know, you can dive into all that, but I spent a good portion of my career working with some folks on both sides of that coin.
Yeah.
There's a lot of opportunity to use new stuff to do things better than the old way.
We are excited to announce that we have launched a Patreon. You can find this newly linked in our Substack and audio platform descriptions. We are both really just so grateful for each and every one of you, and wanted to create a way to interact with you and for you to support us on our journey as we continue and try to talk to the best people doing amazing things in climate tech. We do all of this on the time we can muster outside of our day jobs, so any support means the world. Now, gushing over, back to the show. Definitely, and you obviously you're alluding to spending time in alternative fuels. I want to double tap on that. Is that sort of your experience at Toyota, working there, getting really involved in that area? Is that what you're talking about? Because I know you did some projects kind of similar to that.
I mean, I did a lot while there. I got that was my intro. I got to work with basically anything that wasn't gas. That was kind of what alternate fuels ended up being. So I worked with batteries. I worked with plug-in hybrids. I worked with regular hybrids. I worked with fuel cells. That gave me a broad perspective of what could be done with what. and helped shape some of that. After that, I actually went to go do consulting, though, and I worked with power utilities, and I worked with them on energy efficiency, demand management, and also things like how to manage large loads, like what was coming with batteries and e-mobility. So worked on the other side of the coin there for a little bit, too.
So when you say, you know, you don't need base loads, you know what you're talking about, right? I think a lot of people probably might take that and be like, you know, what is this? What does this VC really know? But you're definitely one of the probably most experienced people with not only looking at it from an operating side, you know, how do you get vehicles onto the grid? How do you get them connections? But then figuring out from a systemic level, how do you handle that in tandem with everything that's going on? I'm curious, when you entered this space and you were looking at, like you said, you did a lot of things at Toyota. When you first heard about alternative fuels, what did it look like at that point in time? Because you worked on it, I think, a little bit before, you know, maybe a year ago, 2 years ago. So at that point in time, what did it look like?
You know, I'm laughing because I'm going to date myself a little bit here. My whole career has been a study of how do I leave the world a better place than I found. It's something that's a very strong personal ethos. At the time when I went out to start my career, Prius was just having come out, the very first generation, not the version everybody knows, which came out while I was there. And Toyota was leading the pack at that time. So that's one of the driving factors that led me to join, because transportation is one of our biggest emission challenges. And I understood, looking at the data, I'd been tracking what the data of the UN IPCCs had meant, even back then in the early 90s, late 90s and early 2000s. And so that then led me to want to be a part of a solution. And so I went to the place who was making the biggest impact at the time, which was there.
And how did you see, I mean, this is probably a very basic question, but at the time, what looked like the biggest impact? Because right now we have so many different metrics about the EV industry. And, you know, if back then it wasn't really the EV industry, but now what we call the EV industry, electrification, things like that. At that point in time, what looked like impact?
You know, hybrids can eliminate a significant portion of both pollution emissions and carbon emissions. You can take a good between 30% to 60% plus emissions out just by going hybrid before you do anything else. So that's what it was looking like then. And the reason people were focused in on that is goes back to tendencies of humans. We tend to overestimate what's possible in the short term, but we underestimate what's possible in the long term. And that really applies to these big, heavy industries. So a lot of people at that time was like, the power grid's never going to change. It's just going to be slow. And we found that absolutely not to be the case. That's why EVs have been really key in taking off, because unlike a traditional gasoline-powered vehicle that gets more inefficient over time, everybody's seen that old car that's got blue smoke coming out of the back. EVs, the grid gets cleaner year over year. Mm-hmm. So that old EV is actually cleaner than the year you bought it. And that's a very big flip on things. And it wasn't even within people's mind at that time.
Was the Prius significant in this?
You know, it's what started the journey. You know, there's a whole bunch of books written about the leaps and steps that Toyota has made. So I won't go into all of that, but I would say it was a very big start in the modern kind of pursuit. GM had done stuff much in advance. GM built the first fuel cell car back in the 60s, I believe. And the very first cars were actually batteries. I got the privilege of getting to ride in one at one point.
Wow.
It looked like a carriage. And they didn't have, gasoline wasn't reliable when the very first transportation options were being developed. And it was really the fact that you needed to jumpstart and hand crank cars that led to internal combustion not being that effective. But as it got easier to turn, that's when it started to win out over batteries. But your first wave was generally battery driven.
That's really, really interesting. I mean, it's not often that on the climate side, you get to interact with consumer. I mean, you can choose whether or not you really call an automobile a consumer product, but it is a more common higher end product, but it is a consumer product. being able to interact and see the journey of electrification is, I think, why transportation gets so much attention, right? Mm-hmm. And why EVs get so much attention. I'm curious, when you were talking about hybrids as this really phenomenal and, you know, advancement, and I tend to agree. I tend to think that hybrids, there's almost a camp of worrying about, you know, the combustion engine going away, what electrification does to putting all the cars on the grid, and what does that mean for national security in the future. There's a lot of different threats that people worry about with full electrification. So I'm curious, do you think there's some semblance of, especially given your experience, people advocating for hybrids over EVs? And if not, why?
I mean, you do have people who do it. They generally are going to have a vested interest in selling you hybrids. Anyone who's advocating for anything, I think you're pretty much going to find they have a vested interest in right. Why. I think there's also, you know, nothing is a perfect solution out there. And that's the thing that you've got to keep in mind. Generally, you're picking, when you're looking at things from whatever lens, you're going to be, there's always a least bad option from that lens. But that doesn't mean it's the same option from another lens. And that's why you get differences of opinion in how that is. Like national security, as you noted, that's generally because right now, all of our batteries are not made here.
Right.
Overwhelmingly, that supply chain is out of China. And we can build some stuff here. It's going to take some time to do it, though. So you're going to have some people who see that as a central focus. They're going to come to one conclusion. Then you're going to have other people who are like, I want clean air. And they may come to a different conclusion. Right. And so really what you've got to decide is, as you as an individual or you as an organization, what matters to you? And you've got to understand, when people disagree with your position, where are they coming from? I think all too often these days, we take things as it's my way or the highway, rather than let me understand where you're coming from, because you may be rational. I just may not understand where that's coming from.
So taking your advice, you as an individual, where does nearshoring and onshoring, especially I think at transportation and EVs, but you know, broadly speaking, where does that fall in terms of how important it is in your diligence process and your investments?
I think you've got to consider it. I invest in early stage though. So really, like, there's some aspect of near versus far, but really what I'm worried about is, can you hire the next 10 people and how good's your idea? And, you know, that's just the nature of investing at the very early stage where I invest. Like, I would love for you to get to a stage where that matters so much we have to focus on, but you've got to earn your stripes there. Is really where it is. Now, that's not to say it's completely without risk. As we found out during COVID, a disrupted supply chain can have massive right. impacts. And there's a whole nother piece of how can you manage that risk if you're in a physical goods manufacturing environment. That's somewhat true no matter where you're at. And it's not a zero-sum game. You can near shore, but you have your own challenges from that. We have generally a higher cost of energy, higher cost of labor. If that's not addressed, then your product is going to have a higher cost mm-hmm. and you're not going to make as much money. And at the end of the day, you know, margin is how you have flexibility as a startup. If you don't have margin, you don't have flexibility, because that money can pay for you to change options and pivot.
Right.
If you have no money, that's where you run into problems.
So I'm curious, you'd say, you know, this basically factors into, okay, unless it affects your bottom line, unless it affects your margin, focus on what you can focus on to get yourself to the next 10 employees, right? And grow your business.
I mean, focus on what makes it work. Like, you know, at the end of the day, my definition of a CEO is chief resource obtainer. I think CEO is a hard one. People right. look at CEOs as if they're some god font of wisdom. That's why you've got to go ask the CEO. And really why you ask the CEO is because the CEO is the one who's on the line to get the resources to execute the plan. And they've got to be considering all of these trade-offs. Where am I going to get the people, the products, and the personnel to push this through? And that's a challenge.
Hey guys, we need your help with something. In order to better understand what you like most about the show, what you dislike, and how we can help you, please take 7 minutes to fill out our listener survey if you haven't already. It only takes about 7 minutes, but it will drastically improve our ability to give you the best content that you're looking for. Thanks for your help. Now back to the show.
Yeah. You're egging me on here. I want to jump into how do you evaluate founders and CEOs, but I want to wrap up this topic really quickly. For me, I found it really interesting that you referred to fusion as something that people get the math wrong on. And I think that's a very good way of putting it, because it's not that it doesn't work, just people don't have a great understanding of it. I'm curious, in your purview, are there any other major things or areas where people are getting the napkin math wrong?
I mean, if you take a step back and look at anything, and if it's not already at scale in the market today, then you're going to have to get through an information diffusion phase at a minimum, as I noted, before you get to scale. That in general is going to be 10 years in and of itself. So anything that doesn't hit that, you're probably going to be challenged for it to be at a target that you would love to have exit. Doesn't mean it's bad exit, but it's probably not your insane exit. You see this all the time. If you were in the very earliest rounds of Tesla, you probably didn't make money if you exited 10 years after you invested. But if you waited a little bit and you got in say year 7 or 8 of Tesla, then you waited 10 years, you made mad money. So a lot of these things I just want to highlight, that doesn't mean just because they don't work now doesn't mean they don't work long term. But there is a timing element to it where things just got to get so far before you can expect that asymptotic growth that venture's predicated on.
Is hydrogen in this information dissemination phase?
Oh, yeah. I did a lot of hydrogen work in a past life. I think we've got a misalignment as a society on hydrogen. It is a solution in search of a problem right now, is what I would say. The problem is we focused on generating a ton of supply. All the U.S. incentives are creating a lot of supply. What we haven't worked on is demand. And there's other countries in the world who have flipped that, and they're working on the demand side a little bit more. And so we are going to have a lot of supply. The problem is, on the demand side, anyone who already uses hydrogen generally already has a source. And that source, while it's not green because it's generally fossil, it's cheap because they paid for all the infrastructure to make it decades ago. And so it's very, very hard for something new to compete with something that's dirt cheap and already paid for decades ago. And what we really got to do is address that demand piece. I think it may be an option, but I don't think it is until another decade or two because of that mismatch.
That's fascinating. So just to clarify, by U.S. incentives, are you referring to the IRA and what that's done?
Yeah, there's that. There's specifically some credits there, particularly for merchant hydrogen. There's also a few other places where you might could make use of some money from like building infrastructure around hydrogen or facilities, particularly if you're making use of some of that. There was a series of bills that went through around the IRA. There was the IIJA. There was also another bill that was at that time. The sum total of those three bills is in general what I'm talking about when I say the incentives. The EU has their own, you know, China has their own different approaches. Japan has a different approach as well.
Yeah, I definitely think I see this not only in hydrogen, but materials is another area, especially when you see these other investments going on in the built environment space. I won't go into that right now because I feel like I plug that almost every episode. It's a favorite industry of mine. But I think you see this interesting dynamic where you genuinely, I don't think anyone necessarily could have figured that supply would grow this quickly, but there's been so many incentives on sort of the breaking ground front of what you know is energy infrastructure and things like that, that you generally have a lot of demand problems. I can think of this when you're interacting with energy grids in places like Texas, right? We don't need to go into that. That's probably really complicated, but I'm sure you can talk a lot to it. You have a situation where decentralization is actually faring better in some cases than centralized, because with centralized, you have to average your demand over a large area, and that just doesn't always work out. So that's a whole other tangent, but I'm curious, on that note, you worked with a lot of, you know, grid analysis. What are your thoughts on decentralized versus centralized approaches to the grid?
You know, I like to think of things. I started my career doing long-term strategy work. So in doing that, rather than picking a single path, what you would do is you'd generate scenarios. And you'd ideally find a few scenarios that have believable paths with some key milestones towards how it's going. And then you can look back as things evolve and you can say, which one of these several scenarios are we headed towards? So in that very state, as you noted, centralized has been the default for a long time. Decentralized on massive scale is another one. In reality, the result's going to be somewhere in the middle. The reason you do centralized, though, is worth noting. It was because it was the cheapest power you could get, because if you did it at that scale, it made it so cheap. And so you're talking about, like, you know, generally coal that's 3 or 4 cents, maybe if you're lucky, a little bit lower than that, maybe 30 years ago. But generally, that's right. What you're looking at cost of production. Now you can actually get solar for 2 cents. So The very precedent that you used as the fundamental assumption, you do baseload because baseload is always cheaper, doesn't hold. And exactly. So you need to revisit your assumptions at certain levels across the board. And this is where a number of technologies get caught up. Nuclear in general, from a rational basis, absolutely love it. There's a lot of reasons it makes sense. But the thing is, people are not rational, and real facilities have to be built in people's neighborhoods. And because of that, nuclear is by far the most expensive baseload power we have. For all new plants. It's not even close. Instead of that, you know, like I said, 2 or 3 cents that you can get to for solar, you're talking more like 15 to 20 cents with the most recent plants after you stack on all the real costs. Like they forecast that it's going to be 8 cents and then 3 cost overruns later, you're dealing with something very, very different.
Yeah, I came across a graph today that ranked the energy prices, you know, in terms of range, low and high range by category, wind, solar, you know, everyone's touting the fact that in many cases they are cheaper than gas, which is phenomenal. But at the very bottom of the list, after gas, after solar, after wind, is nuclear. And at the bottom of that is nuclear fusion, because it is so new and you still need a lot to advance before it becomes economically viable. But, you know, it is sort of a moonshot technology that people are manifesting as the future of energy. So, we'll wait to see what happens with that. I think a common theme in a lot of our questions, hydrogen, fusion, and even the evolution of alternative fuel cells, like you have a really, really good sense in terms of timing and the maturity of certain types of energy and, you know, technologies. And I think that's because you have a unique perspective of coming from both the operating and implementation background to then the large scale advisory and now on the investing side. So to me, it seemed like you have this great sense of timing. So we're super glad to have you for this conversation. That's my sense. But do you think that there's some strategy that you use to assess whether a technology is ripe for investment or whether you need to take more time?
Absolutely. So a couple of things. I, again, invest in the early stage, and you need to invest in teams, not technologies. You know, early on, it took me a little bit to learn that, I will readily admit. Because at the end of the day, stuff happens and technologies have trouble adapting, but teams can adapt. And so you A, have to have that. But B, you've got to also just understand the simple things. As someone who started their career in product, it hurts my heart to say this, but the technology is only the first 5% of the journey. The other 95% of the journey is learning how to build a team. Learning how to build sales, learning how to build marketing, figuring out the location where you're going to do all this, then building a brand, getting people to talk about you, then figuring out how not to torpedo any of those things. All of that's really hard. And I think in general, people underestimate how much time and effort it takes to do that really well.
Definitely. And part of this is you talked about identifying adaptability. How do you do that in your process?
You talk with people and you understand, like when I ask teams questions, one of the things I note is my questions aren't to put you on point or, you know, center spotlight. My questions are there to understand where you are on the journey, because this is a journey towards a destination that you've got a vision for. And so in general, I ask you questions to try and figure out how far along have you got on that journey. Some stuff you're going to be aware of because it's near term. It's a close focus. Some stuff may be outside your awareness because that's, you know, 6 months, 12 months, 24 months out. And you know what? I'm trying to figure out today. So I'm not worried about that. You know, sometimes there's a little bit of both in that. But generally, that's what you try and do is figure out what are those key milestones of commercialization? Mm-hmm. What are those key milestones of company building, formation, and team building? And how do you bring all that together?
What would you say is like the common thing? Are founders dreaming too big or too small in their journey?
You know, it's really hard to say because it's all over the map. I would say as a society, we dream too small too often. There's a lot of stuff that actually can be solved if you dream bigger. And, you know, I don't agree with everything he says and does, but I do think Elon Musk typifies this well by making the problem a bigger problem. He's done some really amazing things with his companies. And so if you can figure out if it's not working at this scale, does it work at this scale? Most of the EV industry would not have worked if you only looked at the initial state. You needed gigascale capability before it truly worked. And so that's very hard to do. You got a lot of moving pieces, and you just took a problem that was this challenging and made it this challenging. And right. So very few people are willing to take that on. You also generally need someone with the ability to write some checks when the downtimes get going, because nothing goes to plan, particularly when you do that kind of stuff. But if you do it well, you've created quite a moat for yourself and generated a lot along the way.
I don't know if this was the quote that you were referencing, but I actually brought this up in maybe like 4 episodes ago. We had Ben Eidelstein from Step Change. He's their co-founder and GP, so they invest in early stage companies in climate as well. And we talked about how Elon's saying of a product should sell itself, right? And how so many of his companies have generated the industry that eventually became the customers for his product. I think what you're saying probably aligns with that. I'm curious, who were some, and maybe if there are any, who were some inspirations in that kind of thinking?
I mean, there was a whole wave of industrialization that we went through from, call it, the early 1820s-ish all the way up until maybe the 1950s, where you just had this explosion of technologies, things coming out from the original automobiles, the original engines, the original railroads, all of these things. They were kind of brought together of, you know, we used carts, but why would you put carts on rails? Well, it actually works, and you can get rid of horses. And if you get rid of horses, what then? I think there's just innumerable people you could look back on in almost every side industry of that too. Because to do all of those pieces, you had people who had to build all the materials, all the aluminum, all the steel. You know, figure out how to do that. Then you had people figuring out infrastructure like power and power delivery grids and all the innovation that went into that. Then you had manufacturing and learning how to do line manufacturing versus, you know, bespoke artisan engineering and how to do that. Then there was a whole education system to train people to do all this stuff that whenever you do something big, again, it's kind of as the quote goes, the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. You may not know what that's going to be by the time you get there, but if you dream audaciously, what you can be assured of is you're going to be an interesting journey.
Another, I've been keeping track in my mind of some of these quotes that you speak super well in quotes. I love that. I love seeing inspirational quotes and things that just make sense. We've been shining a lot of light on the industry, on climate tech in general, but I want to shine some light on your fund and what you do. So just at a high level, what stage does Muse Capital Partners invest, Climate Partners invest in?
Absolutely. You know, the stages don't mean a whole lot anymore other than early, I would say.
Right.
Generally, it makes more sense to talk about like check sizes and how that applies. Our fund tends to, we're a $50 million fund. We write $500K to $1.5 million as initial checks, which means we might could do some early things in seed all the way through to maybe some early things in A, and it makes sense on an ownership versus return basis.
So early seed to early A, do you lead rounds?
We've led about a third or so of the companies that we've invested in. It's got to make sense. Like if you're really going to be a lead and take a board role, we're kind of believers that you're at a critical stage in the company's growth. So you need to make sure you've got time and resource to provide that focus. And so we're pretty judicious about that and balancing the opportunities that that creates versus the bandwidth that you've got to have to support.
And speaking on bandwidth, that was actually the word I was going to use. Is it more based on your bandwidth or the opportunity and your alignment with that?
It's a little of both. It's you know, either individually doesn't matter, but both must come together for it to be an opportunity. You know, on our team has to have the bandwidth to take it on, but we also have to have the passion to want to put in, you know, that full commitment and time as well, because that's what's going to drive engagement, which drives, hopefully, success.
Definitely. And do you invest in hardware?
Yes, about 2/3 of our portfolio is hardware, about 1/3 software right now.
And when you look at hardware investments, you end up, of course, dealing with probably the problem that you present at the beginning, which is if you look at deep tech, you share a lot of difficulties there. Hardware, you're looking at potentially longer time horizons. I'm currently PM at a hardware company right now, so I get to see how that is so different from software. When you first started looking at hardware investments, what were some of the most surprising things? It could be good. I mean, maybe some misconceptions that people have, but what has really surprised you about investing in hardware?
I don't know about misconceptions because I didn't really come from this industry, as I noted earlier. So I kind of came in with my own experience base of why hardware was rational and worked. There's a lot of stuff. If you want to change the physical environment, you generally have to have a physical element to do the change. And so that's kind of where I land with it. Yeah. And I see that's why we see value in it, particularly as a climate-focused fund. The climate is a physical problem. You're going to need physical solutions to solve this physical problem. You know, that being said, there's different stages, again, that people go through. If you're doing the very first of a kind, that's hard to fit within a venture timeframe. It's not impossible, but it's hard. Generally, want to see things that have mostly off the shelf are already done and need a nuanced improvement. If you're going to change the climate, if we have to wait till you solve, you know, world creation problems like fusion, then we are going to be in trouble. What you need to do is improve the efficiency of absolutely everything. Right. That's the key. And if you improve the efficiency of everything, we'll use less energy, which means we'll be starting strongly on the path to addressing the problem. You can go beyond that to do other things like turning carbon into value and some other pieces beyond that. But carbon to value is going to matter diddly if we don't solve the problem of stopping the bleeding, which is efficiency, efficiency, efficiency.
Right. And we talked in our, we talked like before this in our prep call, and you brought up validating hardware. And that's a super, super important thing to use. So I'll just pose the question to you again. How do you validate hardware?
You know, there's a number of different ways to go about doing it, but looking at the level of problem that it's solving is one thing, and what's the state of solution is another. If you've got something that works great at bench scale, good on you, you're not really venture investable from my perspective, because even turning bench scale into, you know, full production scale, then getting full production scale into a supply chain, and then building a sales and marketing team to get that supply chain built product out into the market, we've now run out of time. And so there's a whole aspect of understanding where you are on that journey. And what are your known knowns? What are your known unknowns? And that way I can try and interpolate what those unknowns are.
So would you say that part of your job as an early stage VC investing hardware is to educate founders on the unknowns, or are you looking for the founders that know them pretty well?
you know, nobody knows everything. So I think you got to start there. What I'm looking for are teams that are very adaptable and they learn and they then use that in an immediate way to improve their path ever onwards. There. A large part of success is avoiding landmines, sadly, because landmines can slow your momentum. And if you lose momentum, you may not get your funding. You may run out of money. That's a big, big challenge in our space. So I would rather you be careful and cognizant of how to manage that. Like, hardware is not the place to hyperscale, is my view in general, unless you've got, you know, a Daddy Warbucks behind you who can write a check type thing. You've got to make sure that you do everything well, because one wrong step with hardware, again, because of that iteration cycle, once a quarter versus every other week, means that your ability to pivot is slow. There's inertia in the system, and you've got to manage that well. So I want to understand, how do you think about things? How do you deploy? Do you focus on how do I generate revenue there? Because if you can't find someone to pay you for something until you're really, really far down the field, then you're probably not truly venture backable, is going to be my guess. Maybe, but probably not. Find a way to get somebody to pay you early. Because if they pay you early, maybe you've got a pain point. The number one reason I see in failures that I've seen in our space is people think they're dealing with a pain point rated at a 10, and then they get to market and find out their pain point's really rated a 3. And that's hard. That's hard. You can't get pricing for a pain point of 3. You're fighting everybody. Your margins are low. You don't have a resource, and then it's hard to scale.
One thing you talked about in that conversation, and I think it relates to what you're saying now, which is you have to really understand, how do you scale? What can scale, kind of scale can you get to? In getting to that scale, you had mentioned taking that piece of hardware and putting it part of a larger ecosystem. And so the way you put it, I remember, was how do you make other pieces work together with your product? And you mentioned startups doing this through partnerships. So is that something that you think is relevant for most founders you come up with? Where did that thought process really come from?
Absolutely. That comes from the very kind of statement where people do not buy products. People buy solutions, because people pay to remove pain. That's what it boils down to. If you're asking a customer to give you money, they're going to give you more money if you're removing a bigger pain point for them. And that's how you have margin, to have flexibility. The bigger and more acute that pain point is, the more they're going to pay you to make it go away. And so if you want to know, does your pain point really matter? Ask your customers if you're a top 3 budget item for their allocation for the year. And if the answer is not yes, you are not a top 10 pain point. You're a nice to have. You're not a must have. And must haves can be cut from the budget. Nice to haves can't. Or must haves can't. Nice to haves can't.
Yeah, no, totally. And especially in this environment, I mean, that was the thing that a lot of people reckoned with higher interest rates, lower spending, you know, less capital just available in general. If your technology wasn't crucial to some of these businesses, you felt it. And I think that, thankfully, I mean, you look at climate, later stage definitely got hit. The stage where you invest, things are still relatively healthy. But, you know, what would the world have looked like if that hadn't happened? Who knows? But I think any founder who was prepared for that definitely did better than the ones who weren't. One thing I want to pivot to, just quickly touch on that, because honestly, time has been flying. So I want to touch on a couple of other things. You are based in Denver, and I think that is a very cool place for climate tech. One of the people I work with, Dania at Elemental, is based in Colorado as well. Super cool place. I could hear so many stories. What is the Denver climate scene like?
You know, it's broad and diverse. There's a lot of natural embedded elements, because you've got, the National Renewable Energy Lab is out here in Golden, which of course has a very clear focus generally on things that relate to climate. Boulder has been one of the leading cities in not only the U.S., but the world focused on energy and environment. And so there's a whole cohort of people around that. That's a city in kind of northwestern Denver suburb area. And then you've got Rocky Mountain Institute out here as well, which runs Third Derivative, yet another climate focus group. That consulting group I used to work at, Navigant, their energy practice, which is one of the largest energy focused consulting teams in the world, again, based out of Boulder. And so there's a number of other groups out here, eSource, which is a consulting group that focuses specifically on the utility sector and helps them work through things, is out here. And there's another 10 plus national labs out here. So we've got a large amount of folks. The National Center for Atmospheric Research and NOAA both have labs out here. The national lab that runs the atomic clock that sets the time for the world is based in Boulder as well. So there's just a massive, massive pool. There's folks, as you noted, from other VCs, like I am the Colorado representative of our New York group, just like you noted with Elemental. Then we have some dedicated folks out here. There's really great climate tech meetups. There's a potluck that Yoni Cohen and Allison Myers put on that's done roughly every month. That's really awesome. And then there's a number of other informal events and just some other groups like the Colorado Clean Tech Industries Association. That's how I found my way out here. They have an energy fellows program, which trains people on all of these resources that I've noted and does kind of a broad introduction. So if anyone else wants to move to Colorado, that's how I did
it. Open invitation. I mean, this sounds tempting. This sounds tempting. I'm kind of in New York. Sometimes it gets hard to get used to the concrete jungle, and I've been thinking about that with my future. Colorado sounds like a good place to still focus on climate.
It is. I mean, we're at the front line of it. You've got all weather conditions at all times. If you don't like the weather, just wait. but you also get, you know, all four seasons, but we're known for snow, and it's sadly going to probably be mostly gone by the end of the century. There's a lot of work looking at that as a state because it's a significant portion of our state's revenue.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know personally know many people that would devastate.
Yep.
Super, super interesting point about that. One thing I want to ask in specific is, as a VC in the space and we're in a post-pandemic remote world, how much do you lean on the Denver community and the local community for your work?
You know, I am based all over. We invest not only in the U.S., but North America and internationally as well. So I'm not as geographically focused as some others. There's some great teams here in the region who do have a more tightly focused piece. Next Frontier Capital, I think, is a great group. They're based out of Montana, but have an office here in Boulder as well, and just kind of do a wonderful thing. There's a number of smaller teams built out of here as well that have a dedicated focus. Blackhorn Ventures, which I was previously worked with as well, is out here and focused on the same kind of general climate tech and industrial efficiency space.
Yeah, actually, perfect segment or perfect segue. You spent 4 years at Blackhorn Ventures and before moving to Muse Capital Climate Partners. What were your biggest lessons, would you say, from that experience? It's obviously a very well-known fund in the space. What did you really learn from all of that?
You know, growth is challenging at all levels. There is what I learned, because we grew the team from kind of three full-time people when I joined to, I think we had 13 or 14 when I left. And then all of our portfolio companies went through kind of similar levels of growth. And so I really gained a appreciation for what it takes to build and scale teams and how you go about doing that. And what are all those considerations as you go about doing it too?
When it comes to building out your team, especially as you move to Muse Capital Partner, Climate Partners, I'll note this in the beginning, it's really getting on top of my tongue. You'd mentioned that the team that you have at Muse Climate Partners is very diverse, and that's done a lot of great things for your fund. This is something that I think people are really starting to pay attention to, because climate tech as an industry, as an investing industry, is relatively new. So you have the opportunity to influence some of the hiring practices and team building from the ground up. You have a very even mix of races, genders, ethnicities, you know, all around fantastic diversity. What do you think that has done to the way that you invest and how has it benefited you?
You know, I am very proud of our team. It's the thing I'm most proud of in what we're building and doing, because I, early in my career, appreciated that diverse teams lead to better decisions because different people are coming from different experience sets. And that different experience set, when you bring all that together, can help you cover a broader experience base to make a better overall decision. So our team, we've been very intentional with it. A lot of folks just kind of take whatever resumes come in or naturally come through their network versus having an intentional focus of, we want people of this type. We want broad representation so we can truly pick the best candidates. And that's what we did. We, you know, didn't have any kind of quota or anything as we built our team. We wanted the best candidates that fit the type that we did, but we were very intentional in pursuing and not just letting a passive organic feeding network provide our connections there. And that's how you get people who wouldn't normally surface and pop up, but can be really amazing and accretive to building something awesome.
That's really, really powerful. I'm curious, you mentioned even another type of diversity is in geographic. So as you look at other regions of the world, potentially informed by the different diverseness of your team, how do you think about investing internationally? And is there anything really, really exciting that you're looking at?
You know, every market is somewhat defined by its local environment. You know, here in the U.S., we have very massive, large roads. I'm going to use transportation since it's near and dear to my heart. So we have automakers who make really massive, big vehicles. You go to places like Europe where the roads are small because they were made before vehicles existed, and you end up with a very different skill set in those automakers. You go to Japan where they have very limited natural resources, and you end up with a focus on efficiency. So people are defined by their geography, and that's going to have an impact as you go across the world for all these new technologies that we need as we try to improve the efficiency of everything. To me, that is one of the key aspects of why climate is so interesting, because we are going through, and if you truly improve the efficiency of everything, this is the biggest capital investment of the last 200 years, because you have to change out almost every aspect of our society. That's a massive, massive amount of growth. When Western societies in general are dealing with demographic collapse and all these other challenges and questions about where do you go to grow, well, you don't have to expand geographically like we used to go for city sprawl. Now you can grow just by these organic replacements of the inefficient with the efficient. And there's certain areas of the world that are just going to be better at it because of their geopolitics. If you really want to succeed in a certain area, go to the hardest area that you can find and survive there. If you can survive there, you can probably survive anywhere. If you only go to where it's easy, you may find some niche success, but you're going to have trouble expanding everywhere.
Yeah, that's got me excited. Let's fight the hard fight. Let's do the hard work, right? I think that's the ethos that is necessary for founders, especially in the you know, first of a kind FOAK space. It's not easy, and there's no precedent for most of the things that we're doing now. But the way that you put it, which is this is an opportunity to reinvent the wheel, to color the wheel green. You know, I think this is a once in a generation, once in a humankind opportunity to do something. Yeah, exactly. You know, as we round out, I got to learn some really cool things about you. Before we get into probably the more advice and takeaway oriented section, I read that you love audiobooks, and you know, I think audiobooks and podcasts, you know, shameless plug here, amazing way to digest content. What are two of your favorite audiobook recommendations for the audience?
So I'm laughing because I will reveal a bit here. Most people are probably thinking I'm gonna say some nice, you know, business related thing, but I enjoy my audiobooks as my guilty pleasure, and I used to get a whole lot more time to play video games than I do now. So lately I'm on a lit RPG kick, and so I really enjoy those. And there's a series, He Who Fights with Monsters, that I think the narrator and the author just do an amazing job with. There's 10 books in the series. The other one I would do is Brandon Sanderson, who who was kind of an heir to Robert Jordan, the person who did Wheel of Time, has several series that I absolutely love that he's done, because he just builds these massive epic worlds that are amazing. And they, again, convince you to dream big. And he gets into such detail that you see how things come together in this entirely new environment. And I like to take a step back and look at things from a different perspective.
I would 100% relate to what you're saying. I think it's pretty cool, because I think a lot of other VCs also like fiction books, and maybe it has something to do with creativity and, you know, thinking outside the box. But, you know, we run, Silas and I run a Climate Tech podcast, and I love listening to, you know, a number of other ones. Catalyst is one, of course, you know, some of the other podcasts that we've had on the show. But at some point, I just want to sort of decompress and listen to something different and something that I wouldn't do on a day-to-day basis anyway. So I definitely relate to that and appreciate those recommendations. Yeah. As we close out, I want to ask you, we've talked a lot about founders, a lot about how founders could really stand out. And so to get that specifically here, what are three things founders can do to impress you?
I would say the number one thing is be the master of your narrative. Everything you do contributes to your narrative, both personally, professionally, and as a company. And always be cognizant of that and figure out how you can tie all these pieces together so that it tells the story not only of you, but why this opportunity is a passion point for you and why that's going to succeed. So there's a whole aspect of that that I think people just really need to be able to own and do. As someone who is a little bit introverted myself, as you may can tell, me focusing on video games. But that was hard for me early in my career. I wish I would have learned that earlier, is just, you know, engage, tell the story. And that will make a huge difference. The other key piece there, I would say, is tell the story of what you don't have. So many people are focused on, I'm only going to say this because this is positive. And I would say one of the things that impresses me more is when I see an org chart that has a whole bunch of empties in it, because the team knows who they need to hire next. And they're thinking about that. I really find that that's a level of forethought that I appreciate, because if they can tell me why that person is needed and who that archetype is going to look like, it just forms a real richness to what they're building as well. And then that last piece I would say is go get a lot of friends in the same space and ask them what worked and what didn't. And don't focus on the successes, though. Focus on the failures. Again, I think most of this industry is landmine avoidance. And if you only focus on the successes, which is what we all love to do because it's a shiny, happy, positive feeling thing, it doesn't tell you the story of all those landmines that those successes missed most of the time. And that's where a lot of meaty, good feedback is. Because if you can avoid having that problem hit, then you can avoid losing momentum. And that's a big, big, valuable thing.
Yeah, amazing. Fantastic piece of advice. An org chart with spaces in it, you know, get some friends, or shameless plug here, listen to a podcast that talks to these people, right? And really understand their failures. One of my mentors and a partner of another early stage venture fund, actually General SaaS Venture Fund, in this case, talked about one time he was invited on a boat by one of his potential LPs. And the only question that he was asked was, you know, what are your failures and what did you learn from them? And this, you know, he was very, very great at articulating the things that had got wrong, and that resulted in the investment. So in a way, own your mistakes and just make sure you're learning from them. I think that's incredibly powerful. The last kind of question I want to ask you before I round out is, what are three pieces of advice you would give yourself as if you were entering your venture career? If you could go back in time, what would you tell yourself?
That's interesting. As I said, unlike many involved in the industry, I didn't really plan to end up here, to be honest. My entire career was a bit of serendipity. I never necessarily knew that the role that I ended up in existed until a role or two ahead. It wasn't completely unplanned. I then worked my way over to it once I discovered it. But what I would say is continue being always open to opportunity. Opportunity knocks in a lot of different ways. And if you're not ready to hear, it's hard to follow. So I think that's true of companies and that's true of your career. And so I would keep that in mind. The other piece I would say is, again, towards make connections and networks and friends. You're not alone in doing this. There's good times, there's bad times, just like it is with our founders. And so knowing more people you can talk with is always valuable, not only to help level set yourself and your team that you're working with, but also to help you just better understand and be an ear for others in the future as well. And then the last piece I would say is to double down on networking. As you noted and have been going through, ours is a people business. And so you have to chat with a lot of people because that's what at the end of the day is going to build an organization is the people. It's not the technology. It's not a magic solution. It's the people.
Well, there we go. Logan, I think we've set a record for quotable moments in an episode. This has been phenomenal. I think I, especially in coming up with this episode, I think we got so much more out of it than I even expected. So I really, really appreciate this time. Thank you so much for coming on. Before we close out, where can the audience find you?
You can find me in a number of ways. Our website is Muse Climate, M-U-U-S, again, climate.com. My email is my name, logan.grizzell@muse.com as well. And so those probably are going to be the easiest ways to reach me. I'm on LinkedIn too, but of course, as with everybody on LinkedIn, sorting the wheat from the chaff is a non-trivial challenge. So those are probably the easier options to reach out.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Samil, and I look forward to the next podcast.
All right. See you soon. All right. If you made it this far, welcome to the takeaways portion of our show. Thanks so much for being here. This episode probably broke the quotable clip record we have. I mean, there were so many really, really good things that Logan said. And I think it's because he's a great mix of knowing how to communicate his thoughts and also genuinely having such unique insights, having worked at Toyota and alternative fuels, going into grid strategy, and now having spent at least a few years as a climate VC. You know, what stood out to me was the first thing is the way Logan had his finger on the pulse of so many different time horizons of different tech. I mean, in an illiquid class, like asset class, like venture, timing is everything. I mean, in general SaaS, you can see VCs quoting that the timing of an investment is oftentimes the most important thing about an investment is when you actually invest in the technology. And I think that's something that Logan is positioned to do super well, especially in energy, with how much he's seen and knows. The second is how articulate and conversational he was. He mentioned himself to us in the show and even beforehand that he can really talk about just anything. And I think this is a real asset to specifically his stage of early investing. Analyzing and supporting teams at the early stage is so hard to do when there's so little figured out. And I think it's really all about managing egos and expectations. And his ability to talk to people goes a super long way in that. Lastly, I want to point out a more niche and quick point, but the way he changed my question about the stage that he invested to be more about the stage of the technology itself, I think this is something that climate VC should do way more often because I think it's more relevant, especially in climate, because a seed for a climate software and a seed round for a low carbon cement look completely different. And especially with the climate capital stack and how chaotic it is, I really think more VCs should start referring to it in this way. I had a bunch of takeaways, but those were the main ones I wanted to point out.
Yeah, those are all really quite fascinating. And for this episode, I ended up actually sitting in the background taking notes with producer Alex, which was the first time I've done this. And since I didn't have to worry about asking the next question or kind of tying things together, it was really nice to just soak in what he was saying. That said, he said a lot of things that I thought were just kind of mind-bending and I really liked. The three things I'm going to focus on, however, are on talent, because he did say quite a number of things on that. So the first one is, I think my favorite is, he said technology is about 5% of the problem and people and building the company is the other 95%. This is something, it seems a little bit extreme and not many people have put it in that way, but it just, I really liked it. Right? I'm a really big fan of the talent space broadly. So that was the first one. Second was how they focus on going out proactively to find top talent rather than letting their natural reach of applicants kind of be the extent of their search. And this was in response to how they kind of build a diverse team. And I think it's extremely important to point this out. I mean, as a headhunter, it kind of hits home because there's a lot of climate tech companies right now who are just limiting who they consider to whoever applies to the job and maybe doing a little bit of outreach here and there. Obviously, I'm biased, but I do believe there's a lot of kind of missed opportunities with getting the right talent or at least a better mixture of people if you were to go out proactively. And this is only happening right now because of how many people, especially in tech, have been laid off and are looking to get into climate. It won't last forever, but that's something I really resonated with me because I don't see a lot of people doing that now. The final point was I really liked what he talked about when he said, what does he like to see? And he said something about how founders will sometimes put together an org chart with missing slots. And that idea of being proactive was that just stands out to him as the founders are looking towards the future. And I just really like that. There's a lot of other things that I could bring up, but specifically because I love this talent in general, I wanted to highlight those things because I thought those really, really resonated with me.
All right. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening, and see you next time.